Let's go on to the middle chapter of the unit, which is about the molecular basis of inheritance, specifically DNA. We all know nowadays that DNA is the molecule of inheritance, but it's only recently, really, in the history of knowledge that we've known this. So we start with slide one with an important historical experiment that really was the first to experimentally demonstrate that there is a molecule of inheritance. We have noticed, literally for millennia, thousands of years, we've noticed that offspring resemble parents, whether you're talking about corn, humans, or anything else, right? We realize that there seems to be something passed on from parents to offspring. But what that is took a long time to actually figure out. So it has been reasonable all along to think whatever gets passed on is likely some sort of material. In other words, there is likely a particle of inheritance. Well, this historical experiment really demonstrated that scientifically for the first time. And what they used here, two organisms, a bacterium is one organism, and non-voluntary mice were the other organisms. There's two versions of bacteria. It's the same bacterium almost, except there's two different strains, very slight variations, but it makes a big difference. There are the so-called S versions and R versions. The S strain, S and R stand for smooth and rough. That's simply because of how they look to our eyes under a light microscope. But the S strain, the smooth version, are the dangerous ones. They're virulent. They cause pneumonia in their hosts, which in this case are the mice. So this first group is really not surprising at all. When they injected healthy mice with S cells, the dangerous ones, living S cells, the mice died. They developed pneumonia and died. The R ones do not cause pneumonia, so they are relatively harmless. And once again, this is not surprising. You inject healthy mice with living harmless bacteria, and they survive. In the third one, they used the dangerous ones again, the S cells, but before they injected the S cells into the mice, they killed them with heat. They killed the bacteria. And this one isn't surprising either. Dead things don't cause disease, right? So when they injected the dead S into the mice, they survived that. The important one is the fourth one, where they did the same thing as the third. They used heat-killed dangerous S cells, or formerly dangerous. They were when they were alive. And then they mixed those dead S cells with living R cells. So the only thing alive were the R cells, which are harmless. Nevertheless, the mice died. And so what this indicated is that there is some sort of material that made the S cells when they were alive dangerous that has been passed to the living R cells, making them dangerous. It's the first demonstration of a heritable material. Now, we all know that it's DNA, but they didn't know that at the time. What actually was being demonstrated, at least it works, was what is called bacterial transformation, which you'll learn more details about in 182 if you go on. But transformation occurs in bacteria under the right circumstances. What it means is that bacteria, if things are just right, can take up naked DNA from the environment. By naked DNA, I mean DNA that's no longer in a cell. It used to be in some cell, but that cell has died and exploded, and it's just the DNA is just a naked molecule in the environment. A bacterium can take that up and start using it as its own DNA, even if it's not even another bacterium that it came from. It can be from any organism. That's bacterial transformation, and that's what happened here. So the S ones didn't kill the mice, but the DNA from the dead S cells was taken up by the R cells, and that basically turned them into S cells.
Would that be an example of a horizontal transfer?
Yeah, that's one of three horizontal gene transfer mechanisms that bacteria undergo, and that's also something you'll learn more about in 182. Horizontal gene transfer just refers to the fact that the DNA comes from a non-parent. Vertical gene transfer is how we're familiar with it. The DNA comes from a parent, passed on vertically. Okay, now to two. Well, as soon as the results of that previous experiment were available, namely that there is definitely a molecule of inheritance, the big question, of course, was, what is the molecule of inheritance? Because the other one didn't say what it is, it just says there is one. So that's what a lot of biologists were focusing on at the time. And, you know, it could be anything, because all it says is that it's a molecule, that it's a particle. But, you know, you don't want to just say everything has an equal chance, because you'll never be able to get all the work done to try to figure out what it is. In other words, biologists make choices as to what you start testing that is more likely. For instance, you say it's probably not water, it's probably not oxygen, things like that, these simple particles. And so first they said, well, it's likely one of the big molecules, one of the four classes of biological macromolecules that we've been studying, right? Lipids, polysaccharides, polynucleotides, and polypeptides. Well, they cut that down even more, because at this point in history, we had a pretty good handle on what polysaccharides are doing and what lipids are doing. So they said it's not likely to be either of these two. Let's at least not consider them at first. That leaves two major choices: polypeptides, proteins, and polynucleotides, nucleic acids. Well, actually, at the time, most biologists guessed or assumed that it was going to turn out to be proteins. And their reasoning was, for there to be a particle of inheritance, which seems to be so complicated a process, the molecule itself must be very complicated. So they assumed it was proteins, because proteins have limitless complexity, right? As we talked about, they can have any shape you can design, really. But they kept polynucleotides or nucleic acids in the mix, because they knew that organisms had it, but they didn't really know what it did at the time. So they said, well, we'll keep it in the mix. But they kind of expected it to be proteins. So they narrowed it down to those two, and that brings us to this next experiment. Now, this doesn't really show the experiment, but in slide two, we're very close up on a bacterium, which is a tiny cell to begin with. This is just a tiny piece of it. And these three cyan-colored alien-looking things are bacteriophages. Now, importantly, a bacteriophage is not a bacterium. The word, what does the P-H-A-G mean that we've already learned in words?
Eat.
Eat, right. So a bacteriophage is named for the fact that it seems to eat a bacterium. It's a virus. Now, it doesn't really eat the bacterium, but it does kill it. A bacteriophage that we see here is really, first of all, a virus is not an organism, because it doesn't have a cell, right? It doesn't have a metabolism, which happens in a cell. Really, a virus is just a couple macromolecules. It doesn't do anything on its own. It's just a nucleic acid, either a DNA or an RNA, wrapped by a protein. Well, in this case, these bacteriophages were specifically DNA viruses. So it's a DNA and a protein, and that's it. And this is exactly why they chose these in the experiment, because they were trying to determine from their two best guesses whether the genetic material was protein or DNA. So they're using something that's made out of those two things and nothing else. And we can see that when a virus attaches to a bacterium, something gets injected into the cell and something gets left behind. Well, we already know that what gets injected in is the DNA. I'm not spoiling anything when I tell you that it's going to turn out to be DNA, but they didn't know it at the time. So the experiment was designed to test which of the two pieces of a virus, the DNA or the protein, gets injected into the cell, because whatever does get injected is the genetic material. All right. So in slide 3, we can see the setup for this experiment. It's a really nice design. They did this in two batches using the same viruses, but they did it in two batches, which are the pink liquid and the blue liquid. Here they used a method called radio labeling, meaning they had to keep track of where the two materials were. And they do this, since you can't go in there and look at individual molecules, they did this by labeling, using atoms that are radioactive. They're isotopes. Remember what isotopes are. They're a different version of an element, something that has a different number of neutrons compared to the other ones of the same element. Well, some isotopes are radioactive, which means they will emit radioactivity, which can be detected by instruments. So this is how they labeled the two batches. In the pink batch, they used radioactive sulfur, which is a good choice for labeling just the protein and not the DNA, because DNA doesn't contain any sulfur, but proteins do. Okay? And then in the blue batch, they wanted to label only the DNA and not the protein. And they used radioactive phosphorus for that, which is a good choice, right? Because not only does DNA contain phosphorus, every single nucleotide in DNA has phosphorus as part of its construction that we've talked about. Okay, so these are the two batches. And then they just let the bacteria get infected by these labeled viruses. Then they had to come up with a way, after this injection of whatever it was, we know it's DNA, happened, they had to come up with a way to separate the living bacterial cells that are now infected from whatever gets left behind, the empty shell of the virus. They needed to knock those empty shells off to get rid of them. And they found that the perfect tool for this is really just an ordinary bar blender. And that's because the speed of the stirring is just about perfect to knock all the shells off. But importantly, you don't want it to be so vigorous a stirring that you kill the cells, because if you explode the cells, then everything's mixed together again. You want to keep the cells and what has been injected into them separate from the shells that you knocked off. And that's why they use the bar blender. And then they did that for both the pink and the blue. And then they put samples into centrifuges, which when it spins creates G-forces, and whatever's heaviest falls to the bottom. Well, in both cases, the heaviest stuff is the cells. Okay? And then what is knocked off, that's part of the liquid that floats above the cells. It's called collectively the supernatant. Well, then they used detection of radioactivity to figure out what it was in the shells. I mean, where the radioactivity is. In the pink version, which labeled the proteins, the radioactivity was in the supernatant. So that means it's the shells that were proteins, not the DNA. In the blue version, they found radioactivity only in the pellet, which is the cells themselves. So the cells received the DNA. Blue is labeling the DNA. So that's where the DNA went. And therefore, this proved that the DNA gets injected, not the protein, and therefore DNA is the molecule of inheritance that gets transferred from the virus to the cell, to the bacteria. Well, as convincing as this is, as these results are, there were still some reluctant biologists. You know, a scientist is supposed to, as a scientist, accept convincing results. But some of them didn't want to give up the belief that it was proteins. Some of them even said, Well, what this shows me is that for a bacterium, a simple bacterium, the molecule of inheritance is DNA, but for something complex like a human, it must be proteins. Well, that's wrong, and eventually they realized they were wrong, and it's DNA for all organisms, regardless of complexity. Let's take a look at DNA. We've looked at a little bit of this before, but this is slide 4. And first of all, let me just say something about the use of names here. A typical RNA, which is a nucleic acid, right, but it uses ribose as the sugar, a typical ribonucleic acid exists as a single strand. So it's one polynucleotide made out of RNA nucleotides. That's not what we're looking at here. But what we call one DNA is really two molecules, because DNA, unlike RNA, exists normally as a double strand, not a single strand. And each strand is a polynucleotide, which in itself is a molecule. This is a little bit like a multimeric protein. Remember multimeric proteins? They're the ones that are made out of two or more polypeptides. So, like hemoglobin, for instance. Hemoglobin, we call it one protein, but really it's more than one molecule, because every individual polypeptide in there is a full molecule in its own right. And then those polypeptides are complexed together into the overall protein. Similarly, one DNA, as we call it, is really two polynucleotide molecules that are held together. Not by chemical bonds, though. And what we're looking at here is just one of the two strands, plus we're only looking at 4 nucleotides worth. Notice the shading at the bottom and the top to indicate that this is a tiny, tiny fraction of the overall length of one strand. A typical DNA, which makes up one chromosome, in you, for example, is millions of nucleotides, not 4. The reason that 4 are shown here is to show you, to remind you of something you learned earlier, that if you're building a DNA polynucleotide, there are 4 choices of nitrogenous bases: adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. Okay, but the order of those, the sequence, can be anything. Now, a really important aspect of how this strand is put together is that, since we're talking about DNA, every sugar, remember, every nucleotide has to have 3 parts, a sugar, a nitrogenous base, and a phosphate. Every sugar in a DNA strand, no matter how many nucleotides long it is deoxyribose. So you don't mix and match sugars within one nucleic acid. You're either making an RNA in which every sugar is ribose, or here, a DNA in which every sugar is deoxyribose. In other words, what I'm saying is that sugar is not a source of variability in DNA. They're all the same. And all the phosphates are the same. The only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides is that the third part of the nucleotide, the nitrogenous base, can be different. Compare this to amino acids. Amino acids are all the same except for that one R group that makes them different from other amino acids, right? All the rest of the molecule is the same. Also, think back to how a polypeptide is built. When you build a polypeptide, you use peptide bonds that connect the carboxyl end of one amino acid to the amino end of the next amino acid, and the R groups are not at all involved in holding it together, right? They're just hanging off of the polypeptide backbone. Similarly, the nitrogenous bases of a DNA are not at all involved in holding this sequence together as a sequence. Only the sugars and the phosphates are held together. Okay, and that's what's highlighted in blue here. That's why we call this the so-called sugar phosphate backbone, because the phosphate of one nucleotide is connected to the sugar of the next nucleotide, and then its phosphate is connected to the next sugar, and so on over and over. Sugar phosphate, all the way down the line. This is really important because DNA is an informational molecule. It has information in the form of a code. Well, the code is the particular sequence of A's, C's, T's, and G's. All right? Just like a phone number has information because it's a specific sequence of numerals. You don't have that information anymore if you randomize the numbers. You're not going to be calling the same person, right? Similarly, you're going to have totally different information if you allow the sequence of nucleotides to be scrambled. Therefore, in order to prevent that from happening, to keep the integrity of the information, you need to hold this sequence together as a strand strongly. And that's why the sugar phosphate backbone is made up of covalent bonds, which are the strongest bonds. Those are chemical bonds, right? And no matter how many nucleotides long it is, it's all one polynucleotide. It's all one molecule held together by the sugar phosphate backbone. The nitrogenous bases don't help out at all. They are simply hanging off of the sugar phosphate backbone, but they give the molecule its information because they're the variable part. Sugar and phosphate is not variable. The other thing that's shown by this slide is something that you should already be familiar with from lab, and that is that any DNA sequence, whether it's just a single nucleotide or millions, however long the strand is, in other words, there is a so-called 5' end and a so-called 3' end. The 5' end is named for the fact that it's associated with the fifth carbon in the pentose. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is the fifth carbon. It really is not part of the ring. It hangs off of the ring. And at the 5' end of a DNA polynucleotide, you have a phosphate. It's the phosphate of that last nucleotide. At the other end, you have a 3' end that does not feature a phosphate because there's no more nucleotide at that end. That 3' end has a hydroxyl. So, no matter whatever the length is, it doesn't matter. You have a 5' end and a 3' end, and in that sense, a polynucleotide has polarity to it, two different ends. This is just one of two strands, though. Well, now let's go back to history for a second in slide 5. So at this point, these two important experiments showed us that there is a molecule of inheritance, and then the second one showed us that molecule is DNA. So once we had that pinned down, then the big question became, how does DNA work? Well, you can't really just skip to that question, as interesting as it is, because you can't really figure out how something works until you figure out how something is built. So the work became, how do we figure out the structure of DNA now that we know it's so important? And two men eventually got the Nobel Prize and most of the credit at the time, which are Watson and Crick, and their work was really important. I don't want to downplay their work, but Rosalind Franklin, shown here, really helped out a great deal. Her contribution was very important, but of course, back then she got no credit because she was a woman and she died early of cancer and never really knew that she was eventually going to be credited. Now she's credited in most textbooks. She was a world expert in a technique called X-ray crystallography. X-ray crystallography uses X-rays, which are invisible light, just like used in medical imagery. And the purpose of crystallography is to figure out the shape of a molecule. What you do is bombard the molecule with X-rays, and those X-rays glance off of the molecule in various directions based on the shape of it, and then they strike photographic film, just like they do in an X-ray of bones or whatever. Well, this is a famous picture on the right. Doesn't look like much to us, but to Rosalind Franklin, an expert, she said, well, this pattern here makes me think that this could be a helix you're looking at. And that's what she told Watson and Crick. And so they took her advice and finally figured out and built the first model of a DNA. I guess I don't have one here. There used to be one sitting over there. The double helical model, like the twisted ladder. And that's what we have in slide 6. So on the left edge here, we have a double helix. This is what I was talking about a little bit earlier. We say this is one DNA, but it's really two polynucleotides, each one an individual molecule. There are two blue ribbons here, not the beaker. Each ribbon represents one sugar phosphate backbone of a polynucleotide. The whole DNA, though, is two polynucleotides. Each one is a helix, which is a corkscrew shape. But you have two polynucleotides that are held together, but not chemically. That's why it's still two molecules officially. And the arrangements, since there's two helices, that's why we call it a double helix. But this arrangement is just like a spiral staircase, where the sugar phosphate backbones are the support of the spiral staircase. And then each step of the staircase is half of it, each step is made by a nitrogenous base hanging off of one polynucleotide, and the other half of that same step is a nitrogenous base hanging off at the same position of the other polynucleotide. Well, it's easier to visualize this if you mentally untwist the spiral staircase, in which case it becomes a ladder instead. This is not how it really exists, but it's easier to look at in the middle part. Here's just a piece of the ladder. And now that I've told you that each individual polynucleotide has a 5' end and a 3' end, we can appreciate that any given double-stranded DNA has what's called an anti-parallel arrangement. Anti-parallel refers to the fact that one strand in a DNA molecule has its 5' end situated next to the 3' end of the other strand, and vice versa. So notice the left strand here is 5' at the top, 3' on the bottom, while the right strand is 3' at the top, 5' at the bottom. So it's kind of like this, head to tail instead of head to head, tail to tail. Okay, now the pink dots that we see here represent, as you see here, hydrogen bonds. And you already know about hydrogen bonds. We've talked about the fact that they're not chemical bonds, right? This is why there's really two molecules still. But they're being held together by hydrogen bonds, which you should remember are weak, much weaker than covalent bonds. Well, I talked about the fact that the sugar phosphate backbone has to be made of covalent bonds because you don't want that thing falling apart, or you're going to scramble your code, right? You're going to lose the sequence. But just as importantly, you want the two strands, which are held together by these hydrogen bonds, to be weakly held together, not strongly. And that's because when you think about the two major functions of DNA, which we've talked about several times already, do you remember what those are? Transcription and replication, exactly. Those are two totally different uses of DNA, but doesn't matter which of those two things you're trying to do with the DNA, transcription or replication. To do either of them, you have to be able to read the code, which means you need to be able to get in there to look at the nucleotides, nitrogenous bases. And to do that, you have to separate temporarily the two strands from each other. Therefore, you don't want those bonds to be strong, hard to break. Hydrogen bonds are ideal for that. They do hold the two things together, so they're not just random, but they can easily be unzippered temporarily, so you can get in there and read the sequence and then let them come back together. Okay? Well, another really important aspect of DNA which Watson and Crick realized the importance of in an understated final sentence of their famous paper when they first revealed the structure, is complementarity. That's with an E, not an I. It's not complementary, it's complementary, which is in a sense kind of opposite, means kind of opposite, but what it refers to with DNA is that the sequence along one strand can be anything. It can be AAA, CA, TG, CC, whatever, as long as it's made up of ACs, Ts, and Gs. But complementarity refers to the fact that wherever you have an adenine on one strand, at the same position on the other strand, you have a thymine. So A always goes with T, T always goes with A, and C always goes with G, G always goes with C. Okay, that is complementarity. And we'll talk about why that's so important in a minute. Seven reminds me to tell you about another guy that's famous in this history called Chargaff, who was interested in DNA at the time and was busy sampling DNA from just a huge variety of organisms. And what he noticed is that in very distantly related taxa, you know, bacterium compared to a human, compared to a giraffe, whatever, didn't matter what he took the DNA from. He noticed that always the sample of DNA had just as much purine as it had pyrimidine. So I need to define those words. I don't remember whether we covered this before when we just glanced at DNA in a previous chapter. But DNA does, as we've talked about, use four different nitrogenous bases. Those are cytosine, thymine, adenine, guanine. There are four, but there's two categories of nitrogenous bases, which are purines and pyrimidines. What you can see here is you don't see the entire nitrogenous base, but purines are made, each purine has two rings in it. And pyrimidines have only one ring. By the way, I used to get confused as to which ones were which. The two purines are adenine and guanine. The two pyrimidines are thymine and cytosine. And that's what I would always forget, which ones were which, until it dawned on me one day that the words thymine and cytosine both have a Y in them, just like the word pyrimidine does, which there are examples of. Whereas the purines, which are guanine and adenine, don't have Y's in them. So you can memorize it that way, maybe. Anyway, if you're building a ladder, which is, like I said, what the structure of a DNA is, even though it's twisted, if you're going to allow any sort of nitrogenous base match with any nitrogenous base on the other strand, then sometimes you're going to have a step that is two purines, sometimes you'll have two pyrimidines, and sometimes you'll have one of each, right? If you allow any sort of matching. The problem with that, if you're building a ladder, is that purines are wider than pyrimidines. So if you make a step out of two purines, that would require a wider ladder than you would have on the same ladder with a step made of two pyrimidines, which would be a narrower step. So it wouldn't be a normal ladder. It would be a zigzag. On the other hand, if you just make it always once, every step is one purine and one pyrimidine, it doesn't matter which side the purine is on and which side the pyrimidine is on, you're always going to have the same width of steps all the way down the ladder. And so this explains what's called Chargaff's rule, which is why you always, no matter what the DNA is, have just as much purine as pyrimidine, because they match up. But this is only part of complementarity. In other words, yes, it's true that you always have a purine on one strand hydrogen bonding with a pyrimidine on the other strand. But it's more strict than that. If that were the only rule, purine with pyrimidine, then you could have thymine, which is a pyrimidine, with guanine, right? Which is a purine. Well, I just told you it's always T with A with T, not A with anything else. So it's more strict than just purine and pyrimidine. And that is explained in slide 8. So here you have the two matchups that are possible in DNA. Adenine with thymine, cytosine with guanine. And the reason it's these particular ones that always match up, in other words, the reason it's strict complementarity, is that adenine and thymine are both capable of making two hydrogen bonds that match up nicely, whereas guanine and cytosine are both capable of making three hydrogen bonds, and those match up perfectly. So that's why it's always A with T and always C with G. Well, now to why that is so important, which is slide 9. In this slide and the rest of the chapter, really, the book that this came from uses the scheme that dark blue represents DNA that was there originally, old material, in other words, and lighter blue indicates newer DNA that's being built. Okay? Here's the importance of complementarity. We have an original two-stranded DNA here in dark blue on the left. This is just part of the overall sequence. There would really be millions of A's, T's, C's, and G's. But doesn't matter how long it is or how many A's, C's, T's, and G's there are, if you take away one of these strands and don't let me see it, but you do let me look at the other one, then I can tell you exactly what the sequence is that you're hiding from me, right? Because all I have to do is use strict complementarity rules. So if I hide this, I can tell that this has to be a C, T, A, G, T, because those are the rules of strict complementarity. And it doesn't matter which one you hide from me either, right? I could look at this one and tell you what this one is because of that strict complementarity. Well, that's the importance of complementarity. This is why a double-stranded DNA has the ability to self-replicate, because it's made up of two complementary strands, each of which can serve by itself as a template for how to build a copy of the other one. Right? And you can see that happening right here. Notice first you have to separate these two strands, like I was saying. That's why it's important for them to be weak hydrogen bonds. You're separating the two strands, and then you're individually reading each one. So this is DNA replication we're talking about here. But it happens really once for each of the two strands that are separated. When you are reading this strand on the left originally, that's the dark blue material, the rules of complementarity tell you, okay, I need a TGATC sequence. And so that's what's built in light blue. At the same time, you're looking at the other strand originally, the dark blue, and this one says, okay, I need an ACTAG, and that's what's built. And you do that all along the length of the DNA, and what you end up with then are two double-stranded complete DNAs that are identical to each other, and they're both identical to the original one that you started with before separating the strands. Exactly what you need in order for cell division to be successful, right? Because when you divide into two cells, you have to give both cells all of your DNA. The only way you can possibly accomplish that is if you first make an identical copy of your own DNA and give each cell its own copy. And that's what complementarity does for DNA. So then that brings up a question in slide 10 as to how this replication mechanism happens. And mathematically speaking, there's really only three possibilities, which are the conservative model, the semi-conservative model, and the dispersive model. The conservative model is called this because the original dark blue DNA is conserved or saved in each generation of cells, each time, each cell cycle, in other words. So notice that this second generation of cells, the one that this splits into, one of those cells is going to get both of the original strands, and the other one's going to get a double strand that's totally new material. That's what conservative means. And then in the second generation, one gets the original, one gets newer, and two other totally new ones. They really should have used three different colors here, but dark blue means that what you started with at the first generation. Okay, that's conservative. The semi-conservative model is called that because it conserves or saves only half of the original DNA, which is one total strand. So notice in the first replication, one of the cells is going to have a DNA made up of one old strand, completely old strand, and one completely new strand. Same for the other one. Well, the only other possibility is the dispersive model, which is also the most complicated, and therefore it's unlikely to be the one that's true, because the simplest things are more likely to happen. But in the dispersive model, even a strand is not saved, is not conserved. The strands are somehow chopped up, mixed with new material, and put back together so that every strand is a mixture of old and new material. Okay? Like I say, not very likely, but it's a mathematical possibility. So one of these must be true, and therefore design an experiment to figure out which one it is. Slide 11, another famous experiment. I don't want to get bogged down in the details of how they did this, but I will tell you that the way they kept track of the DNA this way was a different version of labeling. They used isotopes again, but not radioactive isotopes. They just used the fact that different isotopes weigh different amounts. So you can separate one isotope, DNA with one isotope, from DNA with another isotope with a centrifuge, because different weight things will go to different places in the tube. And if the conservative model were true, then they would have had two bands here. One band at the bottom, which is the all old material, heavier, and one at the top, lighter. Well, right away, they disproved the conservative model because that did not happen. They had only one band, which represents something that's half old and half new. The problem is, even though they discounted the conservative model, they couldn't tell with just one cell cycle whether it was semi-conservative or dispersive, because they both predict one band forming, right? Because they're both made out of half old and half new material, but in different ways. So they had to then go to another round, another generation, and the semi-conservative model then predicts two bands, whereas the dispersive model predicts still only one. And they found two, not one. So in that second generation, they discounted the dispersive, and they confirmed the semi-conservative model. So those were the possibilities, but the way it actually happens is by the semi-conservative model. Well, that's background for the next major topic then, starting in 12, which is to look at the particulars of DNA replication. This is one of the major functions of DNA. We'll look at transcription, the other function of DNA, in the next chapter. But this is DNA replication. And we see it happening twice here, corresponding to the dichotomy of cell types. There's a prokaryotic cell at the top. There's a eukaryotic cell on the bottom. Well, the DNA from these cells. It happens more or less the same, but there is a little bit of a difference. Based on things I've already told you, a prokaryote typically has a single chromosome, not multiple, like a eukaryote, and that chromosome in a prokaryote, like a bacterium, is circular. So there aren't any ends to the chromosome. It forms a loop. Whereas a eukaryotic chromosome, however many there are, this is just one of them, they are linear chromosomes, so they have two ends. All right, but they're both double-stranded. And notice that originally we're starting with Both strands dark blue, representing the original material. No new DNA has been formed yet. Well, let's focus on how this happens in a prokaryote. Although there is no end to a circle, there is a particular place on that circle, that circular chromosome, where replication begins. And it is given the very specific, very descriptive name of origin of replication. That's represented by the two little black dots. So in other words, the cell recognizes a specific place on the loop, even though it's just part of a loop. Well, the first thing that has to happen at the origin of replication is that the two DNA strands need to be separated from each other. And by the way, this is shown without any helix. Really, the two strands are helical, so they're twisted all the way along the length of the loop. It's just a lot less complicated to look at if you pretend they're not coiled or helicized, but they are. Anyway, you have to separate the two strands from each other. And when you do that and pull them apart at one part, which is at the origin of replication, you form what's called a replication bubble, which is this football shape. One replication bubble has two replication forks. The points of the football are the replication forks. Each replication fork is really just a place on the two strands where they haven't yet been separated. They haven't been unzipped yet there, but they will be. You have to get the two strands away from each other, though, not only to read the sequence, but then also to build the new sequence complementary to each of the dark blue ones. So that's why you have light blue material being added here. That's new DNA. It's being added one nucleotide at a time, reading the original nucleotide sequence and using the rules of complementarity to determine which new nucleotides to add. Okay, so that gets bigger and bigger as it grows, and the replication bubble gets bigger and bigger as you unzip it further, until eventually you unzip it all the way to the other side of the loop, adding new material along the way, and all of a sudden, you now have two chromosomes, each a double-stranded loop, they're identical to each other, and each one is identical to what you started with. That is semi-conservative DNA replication in a prokaryote. Well, more or less the same thing happens in a eukaryotic cell, except that not only are eukaryotic chromosomes linear instead of circular, they also, in terms of number of nucleotides, are larger than prokaryotic chromosomes. So there's a lot, they're not only long, but they're very long sequences. And you could do the same thing as you do in a prokaryote, meaning there could be one place right in the middle of the length of the chromosome called the origin of replication where you start separating the two strands, right? And the replication bubble would get bigger and bigger until you finally get all the way to the ends. That would work, but since it's so long, it would take some time. You can speed it up greatly in a eukaryotic cell if instead of just having one origin of replication, you have many along the length of the chromosome. That's why there are multiple pairs of black dots here. Each one is an origin of replication. So simultaneously in a eukaryote, multiple replication bubbles are formed, spaced apart along the length. And each bubble gets bigger and bigger, wider and wider, growing toward each other until they hit each other. And by doing it this way, you don't have to go nearly as far, right? All you have to do is go as far as the next bubble is. Meanwhile, all the other bubbles are doing the same thing. You're done in a fraction of the time. But accomplishes the same thing. By the time it's done, you have two identical daughter DNAs. Each one is double-stranded, consisting of one strand that's original material, one strand new material. But they're identical to each other, and they're identical to the original double-stranded DNA you started with. Okay. Let's look at the particulars of how that happens then at a molecular scale, starting with slide 13. DNA replication requires the help of several different important proteins, and all but one of the proteins I'm going to give you the names of are not only proteins, but they specifically function as enzymes. There's one that is an important protein, but it's not working as an enzyme. But this is why you shouldn't be surprised to see ASE in the ends of some of these names. Okay, now notice the color scheme again. This is dark blue. So this is the original DNA before it's been replicated. And what we see has already happened is a replication bubble has started to form. We don't see the whole bubble here. We see half of a bubble. This is one half of the football. The other half would be off the screen to the right, and there would be another replication fork over here where it still hasn't been unzipped quite yet. Okay. And in the middle of that football is, right here, the origin of replication. So the first, I'll mention these in kind of in the order in which they work, these proteins. The first one to work is a protein called helicase, the green one. Helicase is named, of course, for the helix, the shape of the DNA. And the ASE ending tells you that this one is an enzyme. Helicase is able to recognize the origin of replication. Two black dots in the previous slide. And so this has already happened. Helicase has already done its job of recognizing that. And why it's called helicase is that it separates the two strands that make up the double helix. All right? And it moves then along the sequence. Now, there's actually two helicases at work in one bubble. This one is sticking with this strand. There's also another helicase on the other strand working in the other direction, unzipping the other replication fork. Okay? Now, think about why these two strands are held together before any of this happens. Why is that? Why are the two strands held together to begin with? Because of hydrogen bonds and the fact that the two strands are exactly complementary. Like I said, you have to separate them. That's helicase's job. But if you unzip them at one place to form a bubble and then just leave, what's going to happen? They're just going to go right back together because they still have complementarity, right? They're made for each other, so they're just going to seal right back up. To prevent that from happening, you have this second protein, and this is the one that actually isn't an enzyme. The gray one here is called single-strand binding protein. And single-strand binding protein comes along after helicase separates the two strands. Single-strand binding proteins come along and clamp on to one strand. There's going to be another one down here. You see another gray one. And this just keeps the two strands from immediately going back together, keeps them apart temporarily, so that the next protein, which is also an enzyme, the pink one, can do its job. Primase is next. Primase is named for the fact that it produces what's called a primer. A primer is something that gets a process going, right? Like priming a pump, for instance. Well, the goal here is to build a new DNA polynucleotide, a new sequence of DNA nucleotides, right? But there's a complication here because it's not possible for a cell to lay down a DNA nucleotide as the first nucleotide. You can only add a DNA nucleotide to a sequence that already exists, a sequence of nucleotides. On the other hand, you can start with RNA. You can add an RNA onto nothing, but you can't add a DNA onto nothing. All right? And that's why the so-called primer is specifically an RNA primer, this red thing. A short sequence of nucleotides but they are not DNA nucleotides, they are RNA nucleotides. Which is against your goal, because the goal here is to build DNA, right, not RNA. It's just that the cell doesn't have the ability to start with DNA. Once it has the RNA laid down, though, which is what primase does, it reads this sequence and figures out, because of complementarity rules, what the RNA sequence needs to be, and it builds it. Once you have that RNA primer in place, then you can add DNA nucleotides onto it. All right? Well, that requires a different protein. But before we get to that, let me say that the polarity we talked about earlier, as far as the 3' and 5' ends of a strand are concerned, is important here. Polynucleotide, whether it's RNA or DNA, can be elongated by adding new nucleotides to it, unless you are adding the new nucleotides to the 3' end. You can't add to the 5' end, you have to add to the 3' end. So that means all polynucleotides grow in the same direction. They get longer at the 3' end. All right, this primer, as short as it is, still has a 3' end and a 5' end. And that's why the black arrow was moving, or is showing you growth toward the 3' end. Okay? And that presents another special problem that we'll look at in a minute. But we haven't talked about this blue one yet, which is another enzyme. This one is called topoisomerase, as you see. And you don't really see the helix just because it's harder to look at if you draw it the way it really is. But the helix is there. It's twisted. And I want you to imagine a rope. Now, most rope is more than just two strands, but you can imagine just a two-strand rope, right? If you had, you know, two strands twisted along the length, if you had that connected to the wall and you're pulling on it, and you start to separate the two strands at this end, you could do that pretty easily at first, right? But the more you separate them, what happens? Why does it become hard eventually? Right. All this twisting gets even tighter the more you separate the two strands. And the same thing happens with the helix, the double helix, as helicase moves down and zips it on farther and farther. It becomes more and more twisted upstream of the separation. And it eventually becomes unmanageable. So you have this special enzyme called topoisomerase that every now and then will relieve the tension that's building up, the overwinding, by cutting it, letting it flop around, and then sealing it back up. I used to use the analogy of a telephone cord getting tangled after many uses, but nowadays people don't know what a telephone cord is. So let's just go on to 14. Okay, now we've gotten to the point where we have a primer laid down of RNA. That's the wrong stuff, but that's what you have to start with. And now you can add DNA to that. Well, that is what we're looking at in slide 14. This is all, the process has already happened a little bit, so there's already some DNA nucleotides that have been added one by one using complementarity rules, right? The A was added here because it was reading in T. The C was added because it was reading in G, and so on. Notice we're at the 3' end. I said that's the only end you can add a new nucleotide to. So this is getting longer at the 3' end. If you think about an individual nucleotide in a DNA strand, well, pause here for a second and just let me remind you that nucleotide is an ambiguous word, right? Which is why I told you in another chapter that ATP, which is a nucleotide, is better, it's more descriptive to call it a nucleoside triphosphate. Yes, it is a nucleotide, but nucleotide just tells you there's a nitrogenous base, a sugar, and some number of phosphates. It doesn't tell you how many. All right? If you think about the nucleotides that make up an existing strand, each of those nucleotides is a nucleoside monophosphate, because there's just one phosphate on them, right? The nucleoside is the nitrogenous base and the sugar by itself, by themselves. When you have one phosphate, it's a nucleoside monophosphate. So every one of the nucleotides in an existing strand is a nucleoside monophosphate. That's what you want to have in the final product. But notice that's not what's coming in. What's coming in here as the next nucleotide is not a nucleoside monophosphate, it's a nucleoside triphosphate. Well, notice it's specifically one that has thymine as its nitrogenous base, which makes sense because you're reading A at the moment. Okay, so it calls for a T. But why does it come in as a nucleoside triphosphate rather than as a nucleoside monophosphate, which it needs to be in the final product? Well, think about ATP again. It's an RNA, not a DNA nucleotide, but what is the big deal about ATP? No idea what the big deal about ATP is after having exam 3? Right, it's carrying a lot of energy because of those three phosphates, right? A lot more than it would be carrying with one phosphate. AMP is not a very energetic molecule. Well, what are we doing here? We're building a polynucleotide, an enormously big molecule, out of small parts. What do you expect that process to be? How would you describe it? What two words would you use? Endergonic, in terms of energy, and correspondingly, in terms of metabolism, you'd call it
anabolic.
You should expect the construction of a complex molecule to require energy. So the nucleoside triphosphate that's coming in not only provides the raw materials, namely the nucleoside monophosphate that's in it, but also the energy with those extra phosphates required to build this bigger molecule. Just like when you use ATP, you cleave off phosphate, two of the phosphates here get cleaved off, and that provides the energy for building this one nucleotide bigger. Does that make sense? Okay, well, doing that, it shouldn't surprise you, requires the help of an enzyme. Every important reaction in a cell requires a specific enzyme. So this is another protein in this game, the one in the orange box here, DNA polymerase. There's really multiple types of DNA polymerase. This one is specifically DNA polymerase 3, Roman numeral 3. And even if it didn't end in the ASE ending, you could still tell it's an enzyme here. For what reason? Even if it didn't have ASE as an ending, why would you know that it's an enzyme? That's right. It's not on either end of the arrow. It's above or below it, saying that it's not a reactant. It's a helper, a helping bystander, if that makes sense. Okay, DNA polymerase 3 is what's working here, and that's what DNA polymerase 3 does the job of figuring out which appropriate nucleoside triphosphate. This one was a T-based one, but it would be reading it each time. Which one is the next one to come in? And it will cleave off two of the phosphates. And when you have two phosphates held together but not part of a carbon skeleton anymore, that's not just simply inorganic phosphate. It is inorganic, but when it's two phosphates held together that are inorganic, we call that pyrophosphate. Well, pyrophosphate doesn't actually last very long, and it quickly splits into two individual inorganic phosphates that are part of the phosphate pool. But the important thing is that the energy released allows for this new covalent bond to be formed between the sugar and the phosphate, elongating the sugar phosphate backbone. All right? And so there's a lot of energy involved, but it's not energy in the form of ATP. It's in the form of the nucleoside triphosphates that also provide the raw materials for the that end up being a nucleoside monophosphate in the polynucleotide. 15. I won't be able to get through this whole slide probably, but let me just introduce you to what's happening here. This, I told you a little bit ago that there's a special problem because of this directionality of growth. You can only elongate in the 3' direction. Well, here at the top, we have the overall replication bubble, football shape, two replication forks. There are 4 strands simultaneously being built here, 2 of which are called leading strands, and they are situated diagonally from each other in the football or the replication bubble. Okay, so this is a leading strand, this is a leading strand. And the other 2 are called lagging strands. To lag means to fall behind, right? It takes a little longer to build these, which is why they're called lagging strands. The leading strand is easier to build because the 3' end is in the same direction as the unzipping that's happening. So as you keep unzipping, you can just keep making it longer and longer. You're unzipping it in the same direction that it's growing, that the new strand is growing. Does that make sense? But remember the anti-parallel relationship between the 2 strands. That means the lagging strand, which has to be also going in the 3' direction, but 3' is now in the rightward direction for this lagging strand, it's the fork is opening up to the left, but it has to grow to the right. So that means you have to put down a new primer as soon as you make it a little room by unzipping, and then you have to grow it in the opposite way that it's opening up until you run into the previously made primer. So each lagging strand is made by forming a bunch of little fragments called Okazaki fragments. The eponymous word, named after someone. And we'll look at better examples of that once I have longer to talk. But that's the problem. That's why you have these 2 categories. The leading strands, you just need 1 primer for, and then you just keep growing it. Each lagging strand, you need multiple primers to be laid down, separated in space from each other, and then you add DNA until you fill up the space till you get to the previous fragment. Okay, I have to stop there.